You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The minister Louis Farrakhan, leader of the Nation of Islam, spoke on Sunday against the impending war against Iraq. He asserts that if the Bush administration invades Iraq, it could backlash and weaken the U.S. position throughout the world, destabilizing its economy and uniting other factions against the U.S. Today, in part two of his speech, Farrakhan draws a parallel between America's involvement in military actions in the Middle East and around the world as acts of imperial colonialism.
God has never condoned the killing of innocent people. There's no way that you can say you're justified in killing human beings because of your hatred of their policies. Regardless of what you feel, you act on the principle of justice and fair dealing. And killing innocent people is not either justice or fair dealing. Now, liberation struggles, those who fight to free their land from tyranny and oppression, what would you call them? Who were the fellas that had the Boston Tea Party? Paul Revere and the Midnight Ride, the Minutemen, the early revolutionaries fighting against the British crown, tyranny, and oppression. But to the British, they were terrorists. And for the principle of freedom, justice, equality, and peace, we have a right to give our lives. But the problem is they manipulate the natural instinct in the human being to give his life for noble principles, and they give wicked principles a noble name. To deceive the unlearned or the weak, to die for a cause of which they know not. We lost Nat Turner. We lost Denmark VC. These were not terrorists. They were liberators. I could not lie to you and tell you that I don't admire Colin Powell, Condoleezza Rice. They are marvelous human beings. They are now being used as the mouthpiece of a policy of death and destruction. Now, our president is saying that he's doing this for peace and for the protection of the American people, as though Saddam Hussein has power to threaten us. They found some missiles the other day. The range of those missiles is about 90 miles, 150 kilometers. The rocket can't get out of Iraq. But these are weapons of mass destruction. He's a man that gassed his own people. He's a man that killed hundreds of thousands. He's a vicious man. Well, what about you? You, the American people, have been greatly deceived. This man, presidents of the United States, members of Congress, have been lying for years and years and years to manipulate the ignorance of the masses to use your flesh and blood, supposedly for a noble principle, but to advance imperialistic colonial ideas. Think over this. Cuba. Little Cuba. It was a possession of the Spanish, along with Puerto Rico, the Philippines, and Hawaii. America did not want Spain in the Western Hemisphere. So how did they manage that war? They sent a ship off the coast of Havana called the Maine, M-A-I-N-E, the Maine. Huge ship, powerful ship. And somehow or another, the ship blew up. How convenient was that? So their warmongers in Congress whipped it up. Innocent American lives lost because we were fighting for Cuban independence against the Spanish. Thus, Teddy Roosevelt and the Rough Riders, Henry Cabot Lodge and the bunch in Congress, and a timid President McKinley. The next thing we know, America had Puerto Rico. America had Cuba. America had the Philippines. America had Hawaii. And the Spanish were kicked out. My poor little Mexican family. How did he manage to get Texas? How did he get Nevada, New Mexico, Arizona, and California? How did he do this? He started sending so-called Americans into Texas. Texas was not a part of the Union. She was independent. She was sovereign. They got into a little problem. American lives were lost. And here come the warmongers in Congress. Next thing you know, the Mexican-American War broke out, and American soldiers went into Mexico all the way to Mexico City. And finally, they signed a treaty with Mexico, and new borders for Texas were set. And after it was over, America had Texas, Nevada, Arizona, New Mexico, and California. See, the lies of government people who have other ideas, but they're in positions to manipulate the armed forces.
The leader of the Nation of Islam, Minister Louis Farrakhan, in his first speech since recovering from prostate cancer. Anti-war activists have stepped up their campaign to thwart the administration's agenda for war. This Friday, they're planning a one-day nationwide strike when they won't go to work, buy gas, or go to stores or restaurants. Next month, activists in New Hampshire are planning a ski-a-thon to raise money and awareness for the anti-war campaign, and students are organizing a national student strike on March 5th. Meanwhile, the plan tomorrow is to storm the Senate in a cyberspace crusade. Peace Watch spoke earlier today with actor James Cromwell.
A virtual march is, I like to say, bombarding Washington with telephone calls and emails and faxes to express disapproval and abhorrence of the policy of this administration, to afford people throughout the country who cannot get to a major center city to march in person the opportunity to express their opposition to the war. Offices should receive a call every minute. It's my hope that it will be every 30 seconds. It is to bring to the attention of these politicians that they cannot disregard the outpouring of protest by millions of Americans who do not support this policy and who are not heard and not represented and not acknowledged. Personally, I think we have the White House's attention at this. I think they, of course, they put the spin on it that they really don't care how many, what the numbers are. But it's not necessarily true. I remember during the 60s we thought when we marched in Washington, and the 70s when we closed down Washington, that basically the administration said it made no difference to them. They were going to pursue the war. But in actual fact, in hindsight, we learned that Nixon looked out there and realized that basically the war was unwinnable because the hearts and minds of the American people were unwinnable and did not support our continued involvement in Vietnam. These things, although they are not acknowledged, not only do they empower people, but I believe ultimately the weight of them causes politicians to think twice. You know, a politician's job is to get reelected. We're not talking about leadership here. If we had leadership, we wouldn't be in this mess. And we have to show them that if they continue to use this and to violate international law and the Charter of the United Nations, that they definitely will not be elected again.
Now, you and actor Mike Farrell, actress Tyne Daly, and other celebrities are at the Los Angeles County Federation of Labor right now, working the phones, I understand, banks. Who are you calling, and what are you telling them?
We're calling individual citizens. I actually don't know where the phone list came. We're trying to make as many calls as possible and reminding them that tomorrow is this virtual march and that we are imploring them to deliver a message to our leaders in Washington that we should not invade Iraq, that there are ways to contain Saddam Hussein without killing millions of innocent people and spending billions of dollars and destroying the only international institution that's capable of maintaining peace in the world, and that is the United Nations. It has nothing to do with supporting the policies of Saddam Hussein. It has nothing to do with being unpatriotic and not supporting our men in uniform. There are other alternatives to solving world problems besides rattling sabers.
And so when they hear James Cromwell on the other end of their phone and you give them the pitch, are they first startled that an actor is calling them? And secondly, have you gotten a lot of, what kind of response have you gotten?
Well, we've just started. I have been on the telephone lines on a number of occasions. First of all, people are not startled. I'm the guy you have to see. James Cromwell doesn't mean a whole lot to people. But they see me.
And you tell them you were the guy that got the pig.
No, I don't tell them anything. I just start talking about this. The interesting thing is that people are really up on this. It's not as though you have to convince people. people want to do something. Whoever is conducting these polls that show that the president still has the support of the American people backing this policy are incredibly misinformed.
There's been some criticism in the media of your group, Artists United to Win Without War, and of celebrities like Sean Penn and Janine Garofalo, who have taken public stances in opposition to these plans against U.S. plans for war against Iraq. And we heard that musicians winning awards at the Grammys last weekend were urged by CBS not to express anti-war sentiments. What kind of reaction have you experienced for your political position?
What people are not aware of is that when these things happen, people are polarized, and what happens is there is an abrogation of our civil liberties, the right to speak on either side of the issue and take a stance and to be heard is guaranteed by the Constitution of the United States. And regardless of what pressure is put, we have not only a right, but an obligation to speak out against this. So you're going to find more and more people speaking out. You're going to find more and more reaction to it, more and more hysteria from the right about our patriotism and our knowledge. Oh, you actors, you Hollywood people, as someone said to me, you just don't get it. Well, we get it fine. This time we're not sitting down and taking it anymore. We're going out in the streets and telling the people.
Actor James Cromwell. And for those listeners who might not recognize the name James Cromwell of the movie Babe, he offers this self-description.
I'm the tall actor, the guy with the big nose who gets the pig. Most actors get the girl, I get the pig.
The media watchdog group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting notes that an issue as serious as the Iraq crisis deserves the highest possible degree of attention and accuracy from the press. U.S. media coverage, however, is marked by frequent misstatements and distortions of reality, some of which have been made repeatedly, even after being pointed out by critics. Earlier this month, members of the art, academic, and activist communities in Houston, Texas, gathered for a panel discussion to discuss media distortions around the looming U.S. attack on Iraq. An immigration attorney, a Greek Orthodox priest, a former candidate for state governor, and a local sculptor and peace activist joined several other panelists and an audience of over 100 in order to add their views to those heard in the mainstream press and in order to come to a fuller awareness of the issue of a U.S.-led invasion into Iraq.
I get emails from friends of mine in Beirut making fun of Lebanon, very small country. We have 43 different political parties. Each one has a newspaper. We have 48 different denominations. We have 5 different universities, etc., etc. There's a lot of freedom of press. However, it doesn't mean anything. It's what the press here wants to make a story. It's not factual stuff. True, we have freedom of press. You know, we have democracy, but we really don't. In reality, we're democratic. I mean, there's no doubt about that. The democratic country in the world. But in reality, do we all share equal? I mean, if there's no debate, then there's no democracy.
Just to build on that, if you're old enough, you remember the cartoon strip Pogo. Maybe the most famous strip he did showed Pogo on the front of his boat with his little wooden sword raised, and he said, "We have met the enemy, and he is us." And I think this is what we're saying tonight. I'm not sure that there's an orchestrated scheme not to have our press report certain things, but there is tremendous ignorance in the United States, as you said, lack of living in the third world or the two-thirds world. And the imprisonment of the press is interior. It doesn't need to be exterior. Our high school students and college students don't know where countries like Iraq are. They know less about other faiths and cultures. And I guess I know my wife has said many times, democracy in ancient times had to do with the dialogue. And it's terribly important. I know in Orthodoxy we're taught you cannot condemn anyone, but you must be in the dialogue. Now, if that causes martyrdom, that's necessary. You have to be there nevertheless. And I'm afraid that's what's broken down among us. I know just a few years ago in the universities, when I was teaching in one of the Texas universities, a study was released among deans and presidents of the United States colleges, state and private, in which they were asked, what are the most difficult problems on campus? And consistently, deans identified the inability of students to articulate a perspective without anger. You have students in the classroom erupting against each other rather than able to put forward a point and debate it calmly, say why a person ought to hold that position.
I actually have family members in Maryland for whom their greatest heroes are Jesus Christ, George W. Bush, and Rush Limbaugh, not necessarily in that order. I believe Rush Limbaugh has become a cult figure. I believe that he's exercised many of the same tactics that Goebbels practiced with corporate support. He is the voice of corporation. He's on channels all the way across this country, and then when he gets off, a clone of him comes on. For 10 years now, I've been thinking that that's where our nation is beginning to be hijacked. You know the story. You tell the lie long enough and loud enough, they'll listen. And in many places, AM radio is all people have for information. And as horrible as the things that might be happening soon in our name, I keep remembering the most useful piece of advice I've ever gotten in my life from an old fellow one time said, I must have been railing at something. He said, remember, people do the best they can with the information available. So I try to take a deep breath and come back to that. But when I listen to the information available for so many people as coming through Rush Limbaugh's twisted and horrible, barbaric persona, I'm thinking this is taking a toll on our nation.
You know, when the Iraqis sent their 12,000 pages, in those 12,000 pages was a list of all the corporations and the departments of our government that had sent dual-use material to Iraq in the 80s. And some came under all the anthrax stuff and so forth, came from the Department of Commerce, where our own fellow Houstonian, Mr. Mosbacher, headed at the time. I remember hearing about all this, but you couldn't get it out. But one of the primary problems is the money that is in the war contractors in this country and where that money, where those arms go. Now, it's a little-known fact. I saw it in the Middle Eastern Report back in the beginning of the 90s, and you know, you can say, well, you don't believe in anything Saddam Hussein says, but there was a time when he said the Middle East should be a non-nuclear region. And, of course, in this discussion, it's a given that the strongest nuclear power there is Israel. And much to my horror, I learned this summer when I was in Portugal that Israel has 3 submarines. Where they are, I don't know, but they're in use, floating around. But one of the biggest problems, and we're never going to get to the end of it unless we do something about this, the war manufacturing that goes on in this country, the way it is subsidized, the way it is subsidized by us.
Here we are at this point, and we got here by steps, because to acclimate the minds of the people, you can't go all at once, you have to go in stages. And what I want to know is, how can we acclimate the minds of the people who want the war, including the administration? How do we get them to start to realize that backing down or changing policy is honorable and right and safe?
I might suggest that a triage approach might be more in order. You know, there's going to be people who are solidly behind the war. Okay, fine, let that be. There's going to be people who are solidly against the war. Well, I mean, fine, that has a nice good feel good system as far as ourselves is concerned, but that doesn't do any good. I believe the vast majority of the people are basically wandering around confused. The first thing to do in yourself is to get information. Almost everybody out on the street there is not stupid. They can be persuaded when they're given the facts. As a matter of fact, you don't have to persuade them. If you simply give them the facts, most people realize that it's not in the interest of the United States or humanity to get involved in this war. So that would be my advice to you. As I said, just attack the majority of the people who basically are confused. Another thing that I might recommend is what I see so much is a kind of slave mentality. A slave mentality, you know, you say, yeah, that's true, but what can I do? You know, it's always been this way. You can't do anything. You can't change it. That is, I believe, what the administration wants us to have. That's the environment they want us to have. What the administration fears more than anything else is for every one of us to realize we have a voice, we have a say, we have power. That's the first thing to change is within all of our minds to realize that we are not powerless, we are not disenfranchised, and that we do have a power and we can make a change.
Amen.
A panel discussion in Houston, Texas, produced by Renee Feltz at Pacifica Station KPFT. Finally tonight, Peace Watch recently spoke with award-winning author Walter Mosley about his latest book, What Next? A Memoir Toward World Peace.
The administration is intent on going to war. That's why we're having a peace movement. I think that other nations around the world are worried about what's going on. I know that we have to continue the pressure, though. We have to continue to be out there. We have to do more marches. We have to write to our congresspersons. We have to do a lot of work. But I think that the first step has been a good one and has had some impact on.
You have written a new book, What Next? A Memoir Toward World. This has you sort of stepping a little bit out of the role that you've written in the past. Your previous books include science fiction, nonfiction essays, Working on the Chain Gang and Black Genius, literary fiction, and of course, my own personal favorite, Devil in a Blue Dress, and The Little Yellow Dog, and then the bad boy, Brawley Brown. So what takes you into this whole different arena of political expression?
To begin with, it's not different. All of my books have political elements. Black Genius and Working on the Chain Gang were actually political essays, very similar to What Next. So it's not a change for me. But the part of my life that it represents is that I feel that it's important for people to use what abilities they have to try to make this a better world. It's a really important thing. Understanding, when I listen to Ashcroft and Rumsfeld and Cheney turn around and tell me that there is no defense against terrorism, you know, I think they should be fired. Because I understand, well, certainly the defense against any kind of violence is peace. You declare peace, you have peace, you work toward that. And because I knew that most of African America understood that, though wasn't saying it loudly, I thought I needed to write a book addressed to African America discussing these ideas that we have that we keep quiet and silent to ourselves. The first of which saying to African Americans that they're the wealthiest, most powerful, most influential group of black people in the world. And if we don't do something about it, who will?
In your book, What Next?, you talk about a safety zone of race that your father spoke of, how he'd seen black men in uniforms go along almost invisibly all his life. Are there other Leroy Mosleys out there, in your opinion? In other words, African Americans who see this as someone else's war and nothing that will affect them?
I think there are a lot of black people who see this. Well, you know, it's that white man's war. It's not necessarily that it won't affect us, but that we don't have any control over it, and that we're not really the subject of it. But then when you turn around and you see Colin Powell being burned in effigy in Pakistan, you say, well, obviously they know how to make an image of a black man and burn him in public, so maybe we are part of this world. We're part of the problem. We're part of America. And a lot of people, I think, don't recognize that. We're the most powerful black people in the world.
In the introduction of your book, you actually say everyone is invited to read this book, but before you begin, you should know that it has been written specifically as an address to African Americans, to Africa Americans. Do you want to expound on that?
Absolutely. I was, after the World Trade Center, I talked to lots and lots of people, but I realized among the black people I talked to, none of them were surprised by the events. I mean, maybe by the specific event, the World Trade Center, or by the magnitude of it, but not by the fact that it happened. Nobody was saying, wow, were you surprised? Oh, man, I knew that was going to happen. Didn't you know it? And, you know, people say, yeah. And there was a kind of an undergoing knowledge because of our experience, because of the experience of African America, we understood that things were going wrong. And in the same way, we understand how to make things right. We understand how to deal with issues. We understand how to live in a world where we live among people who hate us, for instance. And so I decided to talk to African America, saying that we can work toward this world peace. Not that we're trying to save other people, but we're trying to make a better world. Once we start to exert our own power, things get better for us, no matter how we exert that power. And so that's what the book is about. How can we begin to move toward having a better world?
You also write about a racist doctrine whereby the only true American is a white American. And you say that was true in your father's day, and you find that to be true today.
Well, racist doctrine always holds that real Americans, the real people who represent America, are white people. And I think that's really clear by the, you know, by the Congress, by the Supreme Court, by the White House and the people there. I mean, there's a couple of black people in there, but they're following specifically the agenda set forward by these very reactionary white men.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that these people often believe that their ideas, their notion of the world, is the correct notion of the world. And it isn't. It's an outmoded notion of the world, and it needs to be fixed.
You mean the members of the Congressional Black Caucus are really not...
No, I'm not talking about them specifically, but what I'm saying is that the Congress in general works by a system that has worked by, that you have to become a part of. And I think the reason that our so-called leaders do this is because they have the freedom to do it. But they're really only our proxies. And if we start to say what we want and to express the kind of world that we think is fair and right and just, that those people go along with us then.
Your book, What Next, is an intriguing transgenerational analysis that you draw between your father's generation and his perception and beliefs around his role in World War II and your beliefs and this impending war with Iraq. Now that you have come to realize that you are the enemy in the eyes of perhaps many terrorists, in as much as you are an American, how do you weigh in on that question?
Well, to begin with, I don't care what the terrorists think about me. This is another thing. I don't like terrorism one way or another. I don't like when America does it. I don't like when other people do it. And so, like, whether or not they look at me as an enemy is not an issue of mine. However, I believe that I'm seen as an enemy as by regular everyday citizens in places like, you know, Pakistan and Uzbekistan and Afghanistan, by the Palestinians. My country is waging, you know, a continual war against them. We have embargoes and military takeovers. We buy out governments. We use our corporations to dominate their economies and impoverish them. This is what I represent to those people, and that's something that I want to ameliorate. I say, well, this is not right. My father fought for civil rights for himself. And it's up for me in a world that has kind of, you know, turned on its head to fight and to believe in the rights of others. You know, if I can drink clean water, then they should have clean water. If I can eat when I'm hungry, then they can eat when they're starving. That's the thing. And it's not just outside of America. It's also the prisons inside of America. The people who are, you know, forced to live in these terrible conditions of our prisons and then come out without the right to vote. You know, there's a lot that needs to be changed. And it seems to me that African America understands this necessity better and more clearly than any other large section of our society.
Author, social commentator Walter Mosley, his latest nonfictional work, What Next? A Memoir Toward World Peace. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. by Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. We had production assistance from Adil Hamad of KPFA, Angelique Shofar, Bente Birklin, and Keith Shaljian. If you'd like to support this type of programming, we urge you to visit Pacifica.org and make a pledge through our secure online website, or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 2000. We also urge you to visit webactive.com to listen to archives of past Peace Watch programs and to see a listing of some of the upcoming anti-war events across the country that were mentioned in today's show. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.